Many of you have been longtime listeners and...
signals 8 p.m. Thursdays, and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston, Texas, devoted entirely to storytelling. And it's only on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM radio. Tonight, I'm your host, Tatiana Gago, and alongside a team saturated in talent, they are Drs. Warren Holloman, Mary Edgerton, and Hank Rubicek, along with Greg Audell and Floyd the Wonder Dog. And on the board tonight, we have Michael as our engineer. We celebrate the power of story each week by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on journeys through windows of their souls and transport us to magical worlds before returning us safely to the present. And speaking of magical, tonight is going to be an enchanting one. I've hosted a few shows where tellers come on to tell their challenges, both academic and personal, stories about accepting who we are, and remind us how delicate life can be. But tonight, I'm going to do something different. Instead of telling personal stories, my guest and I will be telling tales. Fairy tales. Fairy tales often involve mythical characters, a woodland setting, a damsel in distress who is rescued by the prince. And destined to live a happily ever after. And they teach us life lessons that are wrapped within the tales. My guests are University of Houston downtown students, and they will deliver us their own version of fairy tales from a Grimm's fairy tale course taught by Dr. Thomas. They are Bryce Calabasa, hello. Joyce Josias Cantu, hey. And Marvin Deaver. Howdy. You'll get to know more about each of these terrific people as the program unfolds. So get ready for some fascinating human excursions through the windows of their souls. Welcome to So What's Your Story, everyone. How are you?
Doing good.
Yeah. Good?
All right.
Yeah.
All right. So, Bryce, let's begin with you. So you're a freshman at UHD, and you're pursuing a major in psychology. You also plan to get a PhD?
PsyD, actually.
What's that?
It's like you want to practice clinical, but you don't want to do actual research.
So you're going for clinical psychology,
mm-hmm.
right? And I know that just a few weeks ago, you were telling your story, the one that you're about to tell, in front of your classmates. And now you're telling it on air. How does that feel?
Well, as long as I can make people laugh, that's the real joy of it, I think.
Okay. And, you know, Cinderella is one of those stories we think about this time of year because we despise the misery and hurtfulness Cinderella endures. We wish her a better life, a wish she is ultimately granted, and we rejoice. It is also one of those classic tales with countless versions, thanks to the interpretations and perceptions of the tellers involved. Right, so your tale is a revision of a modern-day Cinderella story, and it's called Thickerella at Coachella. So what intrigues you about telling a different version of this classic fairy tale?
Well, I did a modernization of Thickerella at Coachella because it's still the formula of female beauty standards, which is, it's very toxic and it's just really awful. It still holds up today, and mm-hmm. I wanted to prove that in a statement by making this rather humorous and vulgar tale.
No, with that being said, tell us your story.
Okay, this is Thickerella at Coachella. Once upon a time, in the wonderful land of California, lived a girl named Cass, who had a problem. She lacked an ass. Cass grew up taunted by her friends, who told her that she would never get a man with an ass like that. Cass desperately hoped that one day she could look like everyone else. Her friends nicknamed her No Ass Cass, and made fun of her day and night. One day, Cass heard that the music festival Coachella was coming to California. From that moment on, Cass knew she had to go. When she told her friends that she'd planned to go, they laughed at her, and they told her, "That seems like fun, but you can't come with us, no ass Cass. How are we supposed to look good with you holding us back?" In Cass's warped mind, their logic made sense. As the festival approached, Cass thought about ways to compensate for a lack of a posterior. She tried working out, but then she got tired after the first week. Then she tried a diet, but gave up after just one Taco Tuesday. Cass felt like she was running out of options, but then she heard about a rumor about someone who could give anyone a big butt for a cheap price. Now, Cass had heard of butt augments before that cost a couple of thousand of dollars, but this person was offering the procedure for just $500. What a steal, she cheered, and she decided that the best way to celebrate was to go to the nearest bar and drink as much as possible. When she woke up, she found herself behind an Applebee's. After puking out last night's hangover, she decided to find the rumored plastic surgeon, and who better to ask than the fine gentleman eating last night's trash from the establishment. Cass asked him, "Can you help me find the guy who can make my butt look big for cheap?" The peculiar stranger looked to his left, then to his right, and asked her, "Are you a cop?" She shook her head, and the foul-smelling gentleman grumbled, "I'm the guy." He beckoned her to his makeshift operating room, located in a nearby van. He had multiple awards and certifications plastered on all sides of the interior that somehow were in the font of Comic Sans, but Cass paid no attention to them. All that was on her mind was the prospect of a new booty that she could show off to her friends. The man prepared his silicone injector and told Cass, "The pain would feel like a sore muscle, but you'll get over it." Cass was in and out of his shop within a few minutes, feeling $500 lighter, but she came out from behind that Applebee's feeling more elated than ever. She ran home immediately to put mirror pics on Twitter to boast about her new badonkadonks, going as far as calling herself Thickerella. Her friends took notice of this and cheered her on, as if they hadn't been roasting her for years. Thickerella's friends had finally accepted her as a member of their party and allowed her to come with them to Coachella. Thickerella felt pride, and also the aforementioned soreness coming from her glutes, which she promptly ignored as she got ready for Coachella with her friends. The squad showed up at the festival with full intent to go crazy and buy an entire paycheck's worth of merchandise. The bass was boosted, crowds roared with excitement, and for the first time ever, Thickerella felt happy. She finally got what she wanted. Friends that respected her and a body she could be proud of. Unfortunately, Thickerella's dream had a price. The soreness persisted after the operation, but Thickerella didn't complain because she believed that her happiness was more important. Thickerella had put up a face that smiled as the soreness got worse, but eventually Thickerella's face changed from a smiling face to that of a face of anguish. "This is definitely a bra moment," she moaned as she laid in her bed feeling worse than before. Thickerella woke up feeling an intense pain coming from her gluteus maximus, but she still trudged on and told herself, "I can't let my friends down. Not now, not ever." So Thickerella took copious amounts of Advil pills and once again met up with her friends with a fake smile and commenced day two of Coachella. Suddenly, Thickerella felt lightheaded and fell to her knees during mid-set of the Kanye concert. She mumbled, "I can't let my friends down. Not now, not ever." Then she stood up, took one step forward proudly before collapsing face forward on the ground with her ass held high in the air as a symbol of Thickerella's desire to be accepted by her so-called friends. Thickerella had to be rushed to the hospital and have surgery done to reverse the damage caused by her junk in the trunk. Thickerella woke up in a hospital bed, confused as she looked around the room, finding nothing but a few flowers and a note which she assumed was from her friends that said, "Hope you feel better." Thicarella felt something off about her body, like there was something missing. Then she realized what was missing and checked the mirror to make sure. She saw what had happened to her. Her pride and joy was no longer there, and Thicarella had become what she feared most, being just Cass again. Thicarella's strong desire to be accepted by her, accepted, and her poor decision to get an unlicensed operation to fit her friend's idea of beauty inevitably led to her downfall. That's why it's important to realize that you're the judge of your own body. True beauty comes from within, not from a strange man that can be found eating garbage at the back of an Applebee's. The end.
Very good. Very good. Yes, a round of applause for Bryce.
Please.
So why did you... I know most fairy tales have a moral, and you did mention it. So repeat again, like, what is the moral of your story for our audience who didn't get it
first time? The way I did my moral was I did... There's two ways to do it, and I'm just going to briefly explain it in within, like, 30 seconds. So there's the Grimm's way, which is implied, which is in the story. It's kind of... You interpret it, and that's the way most people do it. But I took it... I just wanted to get it straight out and do Perrault's. And Perrault, the way he does it is at the end. And that's pretty much what it is. And Thicarella is about... You're the judge of your own body, and you shouldn't let anyone else judge you for that. And no one else's like opinions matter. It's at the end of the day, you're the judge. You make the decision, and it's important that you don't let yourself get influenced by other people.
That's definitely, it's really important. And why did you choose Applebee's? Like, I know you had an explanation to me before when we were going over your story.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the Applebee's thing, it was two options. It was either an Applebee's or a Denny's parking lot. And I decided that Applebee's just sounded phonetically better. Mm-hmm. And I just think that Applebee's, Denny's parking lot... It's like and what a lot of fairy tales have is the forest. The forest is some mystical place. It's filled with uncertainty. You don't know what's going on in there. And the thing with Applebee's and Denny's parking lot at 3 a.m. is that you don't know what's going to go on. Anything could happen. You know, a drug deal, just some weird thing, some bizarre thing on the ground. What, you know, you don't know. You just don't.
Okay, and so, you know, I know this was an assignment for you, and why did you, like, out of all of the tales that there are, and I know this is considered as a big girl tale, am I right? This is considered as a big girl tale. Why did you choose to do a revision of Cinderella?
Well, I didn't pick Cinderella because of Cinderella. I kind of just took a bunch of names and tried to just go through ideas, went through Snow White, went through... a bunch of stuff, and I just happened to formulate the words Thicarella at Coachella, and honestly, the pen and paper just went from there.
No, very good. I know there's a lot of revisions. I know we were all talking about this before the show, that there are a lot of revisions of this tale. There's Thicarella, and then we're going to hear Marvin's tale, Coucherella, and then there's one called Tinderella. That one... I remember showing that in Dr. Thomas's class, and I got the whole class laughing. Mm. No, that spectacular. Good. Very good, Bryce. Okay, so Little Red Riding Hood is a fairy tale that addresses themes like luring an innocent child must be softened some. But it won't happen with Josiah's reboot of Little Red Riding Hood. So, Josiah, you are a freshman at UHD.
Yes.
And what are you currently studying right now? What's your major?
Well, at first I was going to do business marketing, mm-hmm. but I think I'm heading more towards critical analysis. I think that's something that intrigues me.
Okay, so you're going, like, pursuing business or maybe data analysis.
Yeah,
okay.
Data analysis.
So, Josiah, you enjoy playing the guitar, piano, drums, and the bass.
Yes.
So... We have a whole musician in the studio today.
I really love music. It's one of my passions, and I'm part of a band, and me and my friends play.
What's your band's name?
Generation Next.
Okay. Generation Next. Okay. And so, can you sing? Out of all those things, are you?
Yeah.
Nice. Okay. So, Josias, you replaced Little Red Riding Hood. So, originally in the story, in the tale, it's a girl.
Yeah.
So, you replaced it with a young boy going into death on male victimization. That's correct?
Yeah. Okay. That is somewhat the moral. I think, if anything, if anyone wants to go deeper into a moral, I'm fine with it because I try to make it as broad and vague as possible in order.
Okay, very radical.
Yeah.
So, so let's hear your story.
okay. Got it right here. The title of my story is called The Colors of Darkness. Once upon a time, there was a young boy who looked innocent and pure. He had rosy cheeks and a beaming grin. His blue eyes would shine at the glare of the sun. His hair was golden and its texture was sleek. His hands were as soft as a baby chick's rump. His smell was absolutely delicious. His character was charming and his attitude was kind. A perfect boy living life to its fullest. He enjoyed nature's gift, such as the sky, the water, and the grass. To us, it is not much, but to him, it is everything. He lives as if every day was his last. He basks in the sun and plays in the meadow. He has no care in the world. A white soul like him can shine light upon the darkness, but can easily be stained. As the boy shines the light, a wolf hides in the darkness. Unlike the boy, the wolf's features are ghastly. It looked ruined, as if it had gone through hell and back. Its nasty glare beams through the shadows of the forest. It cannot leave the shadows, for they conceal its presence. If he goes into the light, its features would be exposed. The wolf stalks the boy from the distance, gazing at his delectable image. It yearns for the boy's looks. The wolf's desire for innocence was great. The boy would never approach the forest, for its darkness repels his light. So the wolf would just watch, gazing at the boy for days on end, restless, tired, and hungry. One day, dark clouds filled the sky. "Mama, Mama," the boy calls out. "Where did the sun go? Where have the colors gone? Where did the light go?" The mother replied, "The sun is hiding, so the light is gone, and within the sun, the colors also dwell." The boy did not understand why the sun hid away. He went outside and looked around. The sun was nowhere to be found. Everything was dark and dim. The mother called the boy in and gave him a chore. "Take this food to your father. He works on the hill beyond the forest. Take the long path around the forest and stay away from the trees, for in the thick forest lies a hungry beast." The boy left with the sack lunch in hand, following the path that his mother had told him to follow. Only the path was visible, for darkness blinded his surroundings. The boy placed his trust in the path, for it was all he can see. Not far behind, the wolf follows. He stalks the boy from the shadows to hide his presence. As he watched, he could see that the boy was blind. He could not see through the surrounding darkness. The wolf steps out of the forest for the first time in ages. No one could see him, for the darkness surrounded him. The boy continued to walk, staying true to the path. The wolf observed and devised a scheme to lure the boy away from the path. He dug out a new path and hid the original. It would lead into the forest, where he would be waiting. The boy stayed true to the path, for it was all he could see. He followed the wolf's path, not knowing it was fake. The wolf awaited the boy, knowing his untimely fate. The boy had reached his destination, or so he thought. He hadn't instead fallen for the wolf's plot. The wolf hides his voice, so the boy would be fooled. "Little boy, come here. Do not be afraid. I see your sack lunch. Is that for me?" The boy did not know who this person was, for he could not see. He called out, "Is that you, father?" The wolf cunningly replied, "Yes, my son, come closer. Bring me my lunch, and I will share half of it with you." The boy trusted the voice and came closer to the wolf. As he got closer, he saw a large, strong figure. "Father, is that you?" he asked. The wolf came closer and revealed himself. The boy gave the sack to the figure and said, "Shall we begin eating?" The wolf gave a devilish grin. "Not until I've had my share," stated the wolf. In one fell swoop, it had eaten the boy. The wolf laughed, and the boy remained in its belly. An hour had passed, and the wolf grew weary. A lunch like that would make you tired and dreary. He laid in the forest to take a nap, unbeknownst to the wolf. The child would climb out of his belly, escaping through its mouth. The boy was scared and hurt. The wolf still held the sack lunch in its clutches. The boy left it, for it was rightfully his. He left the forest and caught a glimpse of the sunlight. The sun had returned, and colors had filled the scenery. Everything was the same, everything except for him. He took the back home, the path back home, weary and broken. His spirit was shattered, and his body was broken. The colors brought him no joy, for he could only see the darkness. No matter how bright the light was, only darkness surrounded him. He returned home, and his mother was surprised. Her golden boy was now a dirty creature. His hair was discolored with the most unpleasant texture. His eyes were dry and red. His body looked disheveled and ruined. His joy was replaced with irreversible sadness and grief. The mother had asked, "Did you deliver your father's lunch?" He replied, "Yes, mother." The mother was appeased that the task was complete, so she continued on with her chores. The boy went outside and saw nothing but darkness. The sun had gone black and brought forth no light. The meadow was gray and lifeless. The boy scowled and grew angry. "Where did all the colors go?" he exclaimed. He deemed his life worthless, for it had been ruined. His white soul became a greasy black smudge. He saw the forest right across the meadow. He had never noticed it before. Closer and closer he came towards the trees. "I will hide in this forest so no one will have to gaze upon my wretched soul," he stated. He entered the darkness where his ruined features began to fade. No one will see him. He made the forest his home, spending many years in solitude. Year after year, time would pass by. He grew tired of the darkness until he saw a bright figure. Living outside the edge of the forest was a family who baked treats. They would send their beautifully bright daughter on trips to her grandmother's house. Constantly, he stalked the girl, gazing upon her beauty. One day, the grandmother had given her a bright red cloak as a gift. The cloak made her even more beautiful. For once, he could see color again. He wanted more of the girl. He needed more. Restraining himself was difficult, for his urges were strong. He desired her delicious features. He began to grow hungry. The girl continued her everyday errands, being stalked the entire time. His figure would change as his desire grew. Then came the fateful day. The curiosity of the little girl had led her to the edge of the forest. As the days went by, she would feel the gaze of an unknown presence. She looked into the forest, only to see a dark figure. He could not hide himself any longer, for the girl had a clear view of him.
"Hello, who goes there?"
she asked. Suddenly, the rustling of leaves grew louder. A sizable figure approached her. The wolf came forth and revealed himself to the girl, the little girl in the Red Riding Hood.
Wow. That is such a deep, deep story, Josias.
Thank you.
So at the end, it just seems that the victim becomes the predator.
Yeah.
Wow. So what made you want to reverse the roles in this tale?
A common stereotype I would see, she would tell us that a lot of media would use the Little Red Riding Hood formula.
Dr. Thomas,
yes, my professor. Wonderful lady. I would see this in a lot of media, and I would notice that the violator was the violator just because. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, it was rare to see why the violator became a violator. And usually, it's the result of him being a victim. And I think through this story, I tried to shine a light in the wolf, because mm-hmm. I felt as if the wolf was the underdog, because, you know, it's the wolf. And I would, maybe in turn, people could see the wolf in a different light. Something maybe some people have thought of, but not a lot.
Okay. And overall, so what, like, again, like every other fairy tale that we know, what is the moral of your tale?
The moral of my tale is more along the lines that no one is exempt from being a victim. All of us have been a victim to something, and others have been hurt by them in different ways. It is how we get hurt and how we move on, or how we use this to develop ourselves. And I think in this case, the wolf had developed into a bad character. As we could see, he had been violated by the wolf. He was eaten.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And the mother didn't even care. It was just, what is this little rat doing in my house?
Mm-hmm.
So, and how not even in the forest, no one went looking for him. So
it's kind of like when the beauty is gone, you're worth nothing.
Yeah.
That's very tragic. So what did you guys think about the story? Marvin, what did you think?
It's very good. it's a good kind of like sequitur, since both mine and Bryce's are kind of funny. It's really good to have a serious one, since a lot of people that write these mm-hmm. kind of want to have a more like a serious tone or moral.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we call these dark tales.
Yeah.
Tales. What'd you think, Bryce?
Well, I liked the whole premise, but I think what really elevated the whole writing was the performance. I really enjoyed that. And
oh, thank you.
I like when people read things, and what you did was something, honestly, I'm jealous of.
No, and how the way that you expressed it was flawless. You gave each character a different voice, and that's something I'm jealous of. I can't achieve that.
Oh, thank you so much.
No, but good.
I'm flattered.
No, these stories are great so far, guys. This is Tatiana Gago, and you're listening to my guest storytellers, Bryce Calabasa, Josias Cantu, and Marvin Deaver on So What's Your Story? Only on Pacifica KPFT 90.1 Houston and 91.9 in Huntsville. So not only have we seen characters in your favorite stories switch roles, but Dr. Hank will be me for the next few minutes. Right, Dr. Hank?
I think so, yeah. I don't know if I could do as well, but I'll try. I don't know. Listen, can I ask these guys a question?
Yeah.
I love this show. This is really interesting. And, you know, you guys ought to do audiobooks. You really do. read extremely well, and
they do read really well.
Honest to God. Yeah, and you're doing great, Tatiana. You really
Thank
are.
You.
You know, but my question is, and I don't mean to make this, I don't want to give anybody a hard time, but do you determine a moral and then create the story around it?
Well, I'll answer that question. When I create the moral for my story, it's usually like the afterthought.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and then you try to, you kind of like make the story, and then you as like a unfinished stone, and then you chisel
yeah,
it.
Yeah. So what do you say to somebody who says to you, why change the story? I mean, all these stories are changed anyway. So arguably, you're not doing anything different than people have been doing over generations. But why change a story? What would you say in a sentence?
I think I could answer this. I think it determines, as in it's the radical.
Mm-hmm.
It's a radical revision, as in it is the same story, mm-hmm. but maybe with a twist.
Yeah.
It adds a bit more flavor to a story that maybe has been growing stale over the years.
Yeah.
So
that is okay. I like it. Listen, your response is as good as any. You're the one who creates that story. But I love the different kind of Cinderellas, you know, the Thistlerella, the Coucherella. I guess if she's in a flood, you'd call her My Umbrella. Is that what you would do? No, I guess not. Okay. Well, you know, I'll get off of that. I'll do what I'm asked to do tonight and talk about the announcements. Let's start with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, because it's a great place to learn about the art of telling. They meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 at Temple Emmanuel, located at 1500 Sunset, right across from Rice University. There will not be a story swap in December because the fourth Tuesday is Christmas Eve, but do please plan to join the Guild for their first swap of 2020 on January 28th, and be sure to bring a friend. And while you're visiting the Guild's website at www.HoustonStorytellers.org for information about upcoming events, why not get on that page, stay on it, and become a member. And while you're there, also please listen to some of our past So What's Your Story programs. Every program since 2008. You'll be tired of me, but you'll be listening to everybody else, so what's the difference? They're all listed on the menu under radio program. If you don't have a radio, that is not a problem because you can listen to us stream live on kpft.org and on Facebook. We're also on YouTube. As Tatiana says so eloquently, we are all over the place. We'd also like you to suggest program ideas when visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page, and be sure to share it with friends, and we love it if you'd like us when you leave. If you got any guests to suggest, maybe yourself, let us know by dropping us a note at story@kpf.org, and we promise to get back to you, and we really want you to make some suggestions, folks. You know, this show, this station is all about you. It's all about listener sponsorship. So if you've got some ideas, we need to hear it. Also, please don't forget our friends at The Moth at Warehouse Live, the second Tuesday of the month, where you're going to enjoy some terrific stories. Next one is next Tuesday, December 10th, and it's the perfect theme to usher in the holidays, family. And for our listeners who want to take their storytelling skills to the next level, why not become a member of Tejas Storytelling Association and the National Storytelling Network? Both also happen to be staunch supporters of our program. Tatiana, back to you.
Thank you, Dr. Hanks. So beautifully set. Now, boys and girls, once upon a time, years and years ago, I took the Grimm's Fairy Tale course back when I was a youngster at UHD. I did a revision of Little Red Riding Hood, and it's a Perrault version. It's called Petite Rouge. So, finish your milk and cookies and listen up. Ready? Once upon a time, there was a beautiful young girl, the most beautiful girl in all of Toulouse, France. This girl had skin so white and soft, long dark brown hair, and the deepest blue eyes anyone had ever seen. She lived in a small apartment with her mother, who loved her so much. Her grandmother adored her and made her a small red bow when she was a little girl. When that little girl became an adolescent, she still wore that bow her grandmother had given her. She was known as Petite Rouge, Little Red, because she was so small and had the red bow. She wore that bow everywhere she went, and it was tied so very tight, not even the strongest man could untie it. One day, Petite Rouge's mother told her to visit her sick grandmother and take her some hot soup. She'd always walk through the avenue to visit her grandmother, but decided to take a different path through the park. It was winter, and there was a blanket of snow all over. As she walked through the park, the cool breeze caused her delicate pale cheeks to turn into a rose pink color. As she got deeper into the park, a man suddenly approached her. He was so devilishly handsome. "Bonjour, petite fille." "Hello, little girl. Are you lost?" he asked. "I've never been to this part of the park. It's very quiet. Who are you?" "You don't need to know who I am. Where are you going?" "I like your little red bow." "Merci. Thank you. I'm going to visit my grandmother. She's sick." "I see," continued the man. "Where does she live? I can meet you there and keep you both company." "You keep going through this path that leads into the forest and you will see a red door," answered the girl. The mysterious man disappeared before her eyes. When he arrived at the grandmother's house, he let himself right in. He saw her lying on her bed, looking ill, but that didn't stop him for what he wanted to do. Eat her. Before the grandmother could shout, the man ate and violated her as he pleased. Soon after, he left the house and hid behind the trees in the forest so he could wait for Petite Rouge's arrival. As soon as Petite Rouge reached grandmother's house, she noticed the door was unlocked, but thought nothing of it. She let herself in and walked into her grandmother's room, only to find stains of blood all over the floor and walls with the smell of rotten flesh. The only thing that was left of her grandmother was the long nightgown. The girl dropped the hot soup on the floor, then let out a big scream, followed by running out the door into the deep forest, where the man was waiting for her. When Petite Rouge got close enough to him, he grabbed her by the arm and put his cold, bloody hand over her mouth. He put his body up against hers, then kissed her neck and caressed her with his fingers gently. As he moved his hands up and down her body, she began to moan softly, then whimper when trying to resist and escape from his arms. He was so seductive, but she knew she had to fight. He turned her around and stared into her eyes to assure her that he had complete dominance over her. "You're mine. Your innocence, your body, your virginity. That is all mine," he said. "What have you done to my grandmother?" she exclaimed. "You killed her. Let me go. Let me go now." "Now, now, mon amour, my love. It will all be over soon. Let's take off your little red bow. We wouldn't want to get that dirty, now would we?" The man threw Petite Rouge and pinned her down on the white snow, ending her innocence, violating her body, and taking her virginity. Blood was all over the ground, and the screams for help of the little girl became louder and louder. But no one came to rescue her. She recited hopeful prayers to gain strength, but that didn't help either. She then saw a piece of sharp bark beside her and picked it up. She felt the fear and adrenaline rushing through her veins as she was about to stab him. She wanted him to feel her wrath. Before he could notice, she let out a final yell, then repeatedly stabbed him on his back until he got off of her. He screamed in pain and agony, but Petite Rouge kept stabbing him until he fell face down, covered in blood, while she got on top of him. His cold, dead body lay on the ground. Petite Rouge got up to let him rot away. "Burn in hell," she snarled to his lifeless body. Petite Rouge limped out of the forest. She knew she had to report what happened to her to the police. There were scratches, dirt, and blood dripping down on her face and between her legs. She was no longer seen as a beautiful girl, but as a pitiful one. As she arrived back to the avenue, her mind was filled with what she had what she had seen at her dead grandmother's house and the murder of her rapist. All she did was look down on the ground until she arrived to the police station. When she opened the door, everyone looked at her in disgust. She limped to the counter with one of her fists clenched as if she were holding something in her hand. A police officer approached her slowly. "What happened, mademoiselle?" The police officer asked softly. "I killed him," she responded weakly. After she had spoken, the young girl took one final breath, then collapsed into the ground in front of the officer, revealing what she had in her clenched fist, which was a long red ribbon. Her bow was untied. So the moral of the tale is, sweet little naive girls, never stray from the path, for if you get caught by him, make him feel your wrath. No matter if going to church or to a house, he will sneak up on you, quiet as a mouse. Be careful, little ones, no need to fear. Just make sure you are the one to show him no mercy when his end is near. Thank you. What did you guys think of that? 4 years ago, that was done.
Just wow, that was a very fantastic tale.
Thank you.
If I could have one word for that, it'd be intense. Very intense. That'd be two words.
I have two words. C'est magnifique would be the right words to say. I really did enjoy the world building in France, and I really felt like I was there. I really thought it was really creative to use French, a little bit of it, and I saw that sometimes you had admitted it, but it, as I was reading it along with, it was really good, and I think it was amazing.
Thank you, guys. No, that was a really fun, it was a fun tale to write. I remember just thinking about what story I wanted to do, and I love Little Red Riding Hood. That is my favorite tale. There's so many versions, but my favorite has been Perrault. That's why, of course, I needed to add my moral. So, to line up our evening, we return to Cinderella with our final teller, Marvin Deaver. So, you are an English major, and you're focusing in creative writing, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
And he's thinking about doing another major. Wow, you want to go into political science. That's right. So, and you know, fun fact about him, we have another musician in the studio tonight. He can play the tuba. So, I understand that this tale, Marvin, as you described it, it is an absurd retelling of Cinderella, which is called Coucherella. So, how more absurd is it compared to Bryce's version?
I'd say it goes toe-to-toe with Bryce's. Unfortunately, I didn't get to mention Applebee's or Denny's in mine. But I feel like once people listen to it, they'll be like, oh, that was a tale.
Tell us your story.
So my story is Coucherella. Once upon a time, there was a rich man and his wife. The wife's favorite possession was an old couch they'd had since they were first married. The couch stayed with them no matter what. One day, without warning, the man's wife grew ill and died. He visited her grave every day, sometimes bringing the couch to sit and be close with her. Soon the rich man remarried. His new wife was a wicked woman who had two children, both of whom were as lovely as the gout. The new wife made it her mission to remove every last reminder of the old man's wife from her new home. She sold everything, but not the couch. She could tell the couch belonged to the man's deceased wife, but she knew he'd never get rid of it. So, she made sure to treat it as horribly as she could. She'd spill things on it and have her daughters jump up and down on it. Eventually, the girls would refer to the couch as Coucherella. As they would jump up and down on the couch, they'd screech and laugh. "How do you like that, Coucherella?" Yet Coucherella would say nothing due to her lack of vocal cords. The new wife let her daughters do horrible, awful things to Coucherella. They'd make Coucherella do chores, or at least they tried. Chores are hard when you're a couch. The daughters would also call her stupid or ugly, and one time, seat cushion. Luckily, Coucherella didn't have ears, so this never bothered her. One day, the rich man was going into town and asked his stepdaughters what they wanted. "New clothes," squawked the first one. "Jewelry," squealed the second one. Coucherella said nothing. She was a couch, and therefore she didn't have the human need for material possessions. The sisters still laughed at Calciarella. I bet if Calciarella could talk, she'd ask her something stupid, chirped the first sister. Yeah, bellowed the second sister. Something stupid, like a twig, I bet. The man set forth to town. Along the way, he picked what was once his old wife's favorite flower. Later, he took Calciarella to his wife's grave and planted the flower, and the once barren area was soon a small garden. He loved to drag Calciarella to the grave and sit there with his old wife, remembering a time when he was happy. Months passed. Thereupon, the king of the land announced an elegant ball for the young women of the kingdom so that his son could find a bride. The two sisters boasted to Calciarella about how they got to go to the ball while she had to stay home. This didn't bother Calciarella, because she was a couch with no brains, wants, or emotions. Ha ha, the first sister called. Calciarella has to stay home and won't get to see the prince. It was then that the mother chimed in. Well, I don't know. Maybe Calciarella can go. What? Squeaked the first sister. She hasn't the clothes or the manners to attend. Really? Oinked the second sister. Well, who's going to take her? 'Cause she certainly won't ride in our carriage. Yes, of course she can go, spoke the mother, as she grinned a grin that could curdle milk and make apples rot. But on one condition. Calciarella must first clean the fireplace, scrub all the floors, replace the family communal bath bucket, and find her own suitable clothes. When the mother and two daughters were finally ready for the royal ball, Calciarella had failed to do her assigned task, since couches can't do anything besides be couches. They scoffed at her and left in the carriage without the rich man, who decided to drag Calciarella to his old wife's grave garden and sit with her. As he sat there, reminiscing of happier days, he dozed off. While he slept, a group of peasants came upon them and said, "This couch would make a fine gift for the king. He could use it for his royal bonfire." So they lifted the rich man and took the couch from him. Meanwhile, back at the ball, the prince wandered around the unwashed masses and tried to avoid every person who presented a female member of their family as a suitable bride. Suddenly, a group of peasants brought in a couch they had found and left in a corner. The prince saw his opportunity and hid on the couch, pretending to be asleep. People still approached him, asking to dance, but he would simply reply, "No, this couch is my dance partner." The prince stayed on the couch most of the evening. "Wowzers!" the prince exclaimed. "You're the best! What's your name?" he asked the inanimate Calciarella. She didn't speak due to her non-existent voice. "Oh, I see. The silent type. I can dig it," said the prince. "I'll be right back. Don't go anywhere." With a wink and a giggle, the prince left to tell his father of the beautiful couch he'd met. While the prince was gone, the rich man entered the ballroom. Luckily, he had awoken shortly after the peasants took his couch and had followed them to the royal ball. Once the rich man found his prized Calciarella, he dragged her back home, but accidentally dropped one of her seat cushions. Soon the prince returned and found his beloved couch missing, with only a couch cushion left behind. The next morning, the prince set off with his couch cushion, stating, "No one shall be my wife, except for the one who can seat this cushion." So the prince went from door to door, sitting on every couch, woman, and child, in order to find his one true love, Calciarella. Soon the prince came to the rich man's house, looking for his couch bride. Both daughters were willing to do anything to make the prince theirs. So the prince sat upon the first daughter, crushing her hip under his weight. She was not his bride. Then the prince sat upon the second daughter, bouncing up and down while trying to get comfortable. This broke her ribs and punctured her lungs, but it was still not his bride. "Is there any other who I may lay this cushion upon?" the prince asked. "I'm sorry, my prince, but there is no other in this house," the rich man responded. As the prince took his leave, he noticed the beautiful garden surrounding a grave and a familiar-looking couch next to it. "What about her?" the prince said excitedly. "Oh, no, you don't want that old Calciarella. She's old and smelly and as comfortable as a stone," the rich man said quickly and desperately. But it was too late. The prince had laid his cushion upon her as he sat, and in that moment he knew he had found his couch. So the prince whisked her away to his palace and called for everyone to attend his royal wedding. Although the people were confused by the strange matrimony, nobody would dare question the prince. Calciarella's stepsisters and their mother attended the wedding, but they were so angry that they stomped their feet and screamed as they left, which startled the king's horses and caused them to trample them to death. The rich man decided it was time to move on with and start anew without his annoying family. Calciarella lived happily ever after, at least until the prince realized She was barren and could not give him an heir. So he had her beheaded so that he didn't have to divorce her, and remarried another 4 times until he finally had an heir. The end.
I remember hearing that story. You said this, you told this tale at the gender conference, right?
Yes.
Oh gosh, I remember how you had the room just hysterically laughing. Just that was a really good tale. You know, I realized that I don't think, no matter how many times I hear it, I'll probably never get tired of it. So I know before we were on the show, we were just talking about your tale, and you mentioned to me that originally it wasn't going to be Couchurella. It was going to be
Lamparella.
Lamparella? Why did you think Lamparella?
When Dr. Thomas first talked about, she used an analogy about like how Cinderella was about as useful as a lamp or a couch. I wrote down both things because I was like, I could use that. And Couchurella sounded a lot better than Lamparella, so I ended up going with the couch.
How enlightening. No one's going to laugh about that. No? Okay. Whatever. So what made you want to revise this Cinderella tale?
I don't know. It was just something about the way Dr. Thomas would talk about it in class and how it would almost aggravate her about the fact that Cinderella does nothing yet gets rewarded. So I figured, what if you made it an inanimate object and nothing changed? The main focal point of the story still gets rewarded even though nothing happens. They don't do anything for themselves. Everyone else just kind of... outside forces affect it, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do remember when I took her class, she would say Cinderella is one of the most useless characters in all of the big girl tales, even though she considers it as a rise tale.
Yeah.
She doesn't do anything. She just kind of lays there, does nothing. Well, she cries, too. So what would be the moral lesson of your story overall? What would you think?
I mean, as for a moral, I'm not entirely sure. Just the main message I wanted to get through was just to kind of poke fun at stories like these and, you know, just call for stories with more substance.
No, that was a really, really good story. Are you planning on doing the gender conference again?
If I'm asked.
If you're asked to. Oh, yeah, you were asked. You were supposed to be asked. Oh, yeah. Invited, of course. So, guys, we still have a little bit of time. Quick. All right. Tell me, what is your favorite fairy tale and why? Bryce?
Favorite fairy tale in the room or
no, just favorite fairy tale overall, all of the Grimm's tales. Any tale.
That's a hard one. I think it would either be The Boy Who Learned What Fear Was or
I remember.
Yeah, it's a goofy story and he just like it's so goofy cuz he's just so unfazed by everything. It's either that or I think one that really struck me was Rumpelstiltskin, and I wasn't even there for that day, but I did read about it, and there's a version where he gets so angry he just tears himself in half, and I just think that's absolutely gruesome.
He just throws a tantrum, and Rumpelstiltskin, that name, I remember she said, it means absolutely nothing. Mm. It doesn't mean anything, right? Ooh, there's like no translation to it. Right. All right, Josiah, what's your favorite tale?
I agree. I think Rumpelstiltskin is one of my favorite tales. I mean, he does literally the opposite of what like male stereotypes would do, and he gets attacked for it in the tell. And I think what's ridiculous is that at the end, throw a tantrum. I'm like, wait, so it's just this guy and he just throws a tantrum at the end of the tale. It sounds like it's one of those bittersweet endings where you think he's a bad guy, but he really isn't. He's like a really cool guy. And I think this is one of the first tales that would actually help me understand what going against the grain actually meant.
And I remember when I read this, like the very first time, everybody in the classroom thought that Rumpelstiltskin was a cannibal. But really what he was doing, because he was like mixing a pot and he wanted a baby, right? Yeah, that's what he wanted. And people thought in the class that, oh, he's going to eat him. No, we don't know what he was trying to do. He was probably trying to make it a bit more, I guess, more welcoming environment. And, well, what about you? Marvin?
For Grimm's, I'm not sure, but I remember growing up, some of my favorite tales were Aesop's Fables. I don't know if anyone knows those.
Oh, classics.
Those are the ones.
No,
yeah,
I
the
don't.
Classic ones. No, there, it's a- the one.
What is it called? Aesop's
Fables.
Oh, no,
you've never
I know.
Heard of Aesop Fables?
No.
And you call yourself
yeah, they're really old. And they also had messages in them similar to Grimm's. Mm-hmm. There was one about, like, it was a man that wanted an axe. You know which one I'm talking about?
I know and the one about the crow.
The crow, those where he, like, puts the pebbles in the water.
Yeah.
There's some where it's like a dog talking to a wolf, and like, oh no, it was a donkey to a horse or something. I remember they're all really interesting. They're really old. I think they're Greek, if I'm correct.
Aesop sounds Greek. It's close
pretty
enough.
Greek. Yeah, but no, those are always my favorite growing up.
Okay, very nice. And you know, maybe at the gender conference you can do a tale called Cinderfella. No, no one's gonna laugh at that. No, okay, I'll go home. No, guys, no, but these were really good tales. Did any of you have a storyteller in the house growing up?
Nope.
No?
I don't think so. I just remember reading a lot in school.
Well, maybe you've all become the storytellers.
I had my dad. He's a really good storyteller. Tells me about all his stories from his childhood. Very funny. I think I get it from him.
All right. And you guys have any shout-outs? Anyone who you want to mention out in the airwaves tonight?
Well, we've shout out like Dr. Thomas a bunch
oh, yeah.
of times.
Hi, Dr. Thomas.
Dr. Thomas, you're the G. I mean, I think the person I'd like to shout out is, I think if, the people who got me here, Mr. Watts, if you're out here, I like you. You're pretty cool. Best orchestra teacher I've ever had.
Wonderful. So, thank you guys for being on here tonight. Tonight we had magnificent revised Grimm's Tales told by three talented young men. Thank you, Bryce Calabasa, Josias Cantu, and Marvin Deaver for joining me here in the studio tonight. And you know, we hope to have you guys back one day. We're going to end the show tonight with one of my favorite tunes that fits well with tonight's theme, and that is Meet Me in the Woods by Lord Huron. Don't touch that dial, because Lars and the Tennyson tape deck is up next with a sweet, sweet mix of singer-songwriters. Make 90.1 a part of your everyday. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Tatiana Gago, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
KPFT makes a difference with real people, real stories, and real voices.
I was put in a room where I was hung by my arms. I couldn't sit down. I couldn't rest all the time with a bag over my head.
Whether it's hearing music that opens your mind or radio that stirs your soul. You know you can count on KPFT to bring you the stories and the people behind the stories.
The Shock Doctrine. What I'm calling the Shock Doctrine is a philosophy of power. It's a doctrine of domination.
This is radio worth supporting, and you make a difference. Visit kpft.org to view our complete program schedule. Give feedback on our shows or pledge online. This is listener-sponsored, commercial-free Pacifica Radio, 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Helping out at KPFT isn't all meetings and telephones.
One committee works your brain and your body.
And we don't mean throwing things at each other.
The building committee handles structural improvements to KPFT.
From new shelving to sheetrocking to a wheelchair access ramp, the building committee makes a difference in what's on the air by keeping KPFT studios in shape.
We're a committee composed of volunteers who care about KPFT, and we're happy to get our hands dirty to help the station.
Workdays are conveniently scheduled on weekends, and you'll get to meet lots of fellow listeners, have oodles of fun, and make a difference.
So what are you waiting for? Put your hands to work helping your community radio station.
Call 713-526-4000 for more information about KPFT's building committee.
We meet regularly at the studio, 419 Lovett Boulevard.
Don't forget to wear some work clothes and a smile. Yeah, don't come naked.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio.
Commercial free and listen.